From Michigan Radio, this is Stateside. I'm Cynthia Canty. Today, Democratic candidate for Governor Gretchen Whitmer talks about Michigan students and literacy.
The prevailing philosophy in Lansing right now is that kids don't have a constitutional right to literacy. That will end when I'm elected governor.
What could climate change mean for our sand dunes and coasts?
If the lake goes up, there are certain areas of the coastline that are going to be flooded where people happen to live or have businesses and whatnot in towns and marinas and things like that.
Plus, John U. Bacon on that Michigan loss to Notre Dame.
No joy in Mudville for this Michigan fan base. And again, it's kind of like being a Red Sox fan in 2000. You've not won the World Series since 1918. It's not the current team's fault, but you've been unhappy for 82 years.
Those stories and much more for you today on Stateside. Hello and welcome to Stateside. I'm Cynthia Canty. Between now and Election Day, Stateside will have a series of short talks with statewide candidates focusing on a single issue. We start with literacy. Last Friday, we heard from GOP gubernatorial candidate Bill Schuette.
What I want to do is grade our schools A through F. I want to provide grants for those schools that are showing improvement. I support incentives. This is all about having a culture of reading in Michigan. And when I'm governor, Michigan's children will read.
Well, now we turn to the Democratic candidate for governor, Gretchen Whitmer. Senator Whitmer, the MSTEP test results came out last week and showed despite more than $100 million being invested by the state in improving reading skills in past years, reading scores were down. Just 44% of students in grades 3 through 8 passed that test, which continues a downward trend. What is your plan to improve literacy in Michigan schools?
Well, Cynthia, you know, the education of our kids is one of the most important things we can do, not just for pulling people out of poverty and ensuring everyone's got a level playing field and the skills to get into high-wage jobs, but it's also something that every time we do it well, we save ourselves dollars in different parts of the state budget. And this was what we used to be known for, and right now in Michigan, we're in the bottom 10 in our country. And all sorts of measurements. And that's why, as governor, literacy is going to be my priority. It is something that we're going to triple the number of literacy coaches in our schools. We're going to treat teachers with respect and support so we get great people to go into education and stay in education. And, you know, we're going to ensure that every child's got the wraparound supports that they need to be successful. The prevailing philosophy in Lansing right now is that kids don't have a constitutional right to literacy. That will end when I'm elected governor because we're going to make sure every child is reading and not penalized if they're not able to, but supported so they can.
There's a very significant disparity between student scores in the wealthiest schools and those students attending low-income districts. What does that tell you?
Well, it tells me that we're failing kids who need a great education the most, that we are doing it backwards and we haven't learned anything from all of the studies that have been done. We know that children in high poverty districts cost more to educate, and yet we spend less to educate kids in poor districts. And that's why I support a weighted foundation allowance. That's why I know that we don't need to reinvent the wheel here in Michigan, but we need to learn the lessons that have proven time and time again that children in high poverty districts need wraparound support so they can be successful. And that's why my plan reflects that. It's driven by science and driven by a goal of ensuring every child can read by the end of third grade, not to embarrass them, not to penalize them, but to support them so we're all successful.
In an interview with the Detroit Journalism Cooperative, you said, when you look at states that are turning around districts, they put more resources in. But conservatives say throwing more money at schools doesn't mean better results. And if that's the case, how do you make those additional resources work?
Well, conservatives who have been deciding our state budget have been stealing money out of our education system for years. Right now, about $750 million annually is taken out of the school aid fund to backfill holes in the general fund. Now, money alone does not solve every issue that we confront as a state in education. However, ensuring that our kids are getting the support that they need to be successful is one piece of the solution. We also need to ensure we get great educators in the classroom with our kids, that every child's got the wraparound services that they need to be successful. These are all pieces of successful education systems that we're missing here in Michigan.
Where do you find additional resources? Are we borrowing from Peter to pay Paul?
Well, you know, what we're doing right now is letting the governor and the Republican legislature take money that was intended for the education of our kids and use it to plug other budget holes. It's foolish to think that we can take money out of kids' education and we're not all going to pay a price for it down the road. We get one chance to educate a child, and the one thing that we should be able to do well as a state is to level the playing field through a good education. And that's why drawing a line, making sure that every dollar that's supposed to go into our kids' education actually gets there. And that's what I'm going to do as governor.
Next year is when the third grade reading readiness law kicks in, and students in third grade, if that MSTEP test reveals they're behind in their reading by a year or more, they could be held back. What do you want to say about that approach?
That's ridiculous. This is the Republican solution, is to penalize kids who don't have the support to be successful. And you know what? It flies in the face of all the science that says for our youngest learners, they need wraparound supports. They need the literacy coaches. That's why I want to triple the number of literacy coaches across our state. As states prepare their budgets, they look to what are the literacy rates when they decide how many prisons to build. This third grade reading is a fundamental, and penalizing kids without giving them support to be successful is the worst thing a state can do. We're going to wrap our kids with the supports that they need to be successful, and if they're struggling to meet expectations, we're going to ensure that they've got additional support so that every child is a learner. Because if you're not reading when you leave third grade, you're not learning. And when that's the case, everyone in our state pays a price for that. So we've got a phenomenal state. We've got a lot of opportunity, but we need a governor who is going to fund education, support educators, and ensure every child can read by the end of third grade, not holding them back.
We've been talking about literacy among Michigan school children with the Democratic candidate for governor, Gretchen Whitmer. Thank you so much for talking with us.
I look forward to our next conversation.
¥50,000 students in Michigan's largest school district came back to school buildings today where the drinking water has been shut off. Higher than acceptable levels of copper or lead forced Detroit school officials to limit access to water in those buildings. And now, instead of using drinking fountains, students will drink from water coolers or they'll use bottled water. Michigan Radio Sarah Swick is here with us. Sarah, we saw this in 2015 in Flint. Here we are talking about Detroit. So how is this working for this first day of school?
I just want to be clear. When we say they shut off the water to all Detroit public schools, they didn't shut off all the water. They're just shut off the drinking water. So water fountains, for example, and sinks, there's no water that is going to them. But there is water for, you know, bathrooms, using flushing toilets, washing your hands. And the drinking water situation actually at the one school that I visited and heard anecdotally about some others was the district has already delivered water coolers to all the schools for students and staff to drink from. So it didn't seem like on the first day of school anyway that this drinking water issue was such a big deal in terms of, you know, everybody just getting back to school.
Now, why did the DPSCD decide to turn off the drinking water in all of its schools?
Well, the short answer is, according to the superintendent, Nikolai Vitti, it was out of an abundance of caution. They did some initial rounds of testing, and the tests came back for about 50 schools so far. And at 34 of those schools, one or more water sources tested showed high levels of or higher than acceptable levels of copper or lead. So Dr. Vitti's reasoning was statistically going, if that trend continues, they're going to have 60 to 70 schools with elevated levels at some water source. So he made the decision to just shut down all of the drinking water sources at all of the schools, just like he said, out of an abundance of caution.
As my mother used to say, it's better to be safe than to be sorry. What else are we hearing from Superintendent Vitti?
Well, he wanted to be very clear that this is something that the district undertook proactively, and that it just wanted to know once and for all about the safety of all of its water sources, and that this turned out to be justified, based on these initial round of test results. But Dr. Vitti has been pretty clear and pretty vocal about the fact that this is something they did voluntarily, because state law, federal law, local law, nothing requires schools to test all of their water sources for elevated levels of copper and lead. And Dr. Vitti thinks that that's not right.
We should be water testing throughout this country in every school and every water source, especially in the city of Detroit.
What about parents, Sarah? What are we hearing from them?
From the couple that I was able to speak with and just anecdotally hearing sort of word of mouth, most parents seem pretty happy that the district undertook this effort and that they're keeping them informed and that they're being fairly transparent about the results and the reasoning behind this. I suppose it helps that the district does seem to have a short-term plan in place for providing drinking water. But I did talk to one parent, Dantes Moss, who said that he thought that everything should probably work out okay.
Well, if it's safe to wash your hands, the danger is out the way, right? So I guess for the most part, we probably get lead in our own pipes too. So I think everything would be okay.
Any idea, Sarah, how long this might last? Because the Flint kids are still using bottled water and drinking from water coolers 3 years later.
Right. Well, they've got probably a couple more months or at least a few more weeks before all of the test results come in. So they have to wait for those before they decide on shorter and longer term plan of action. Dr. Vitti was saying he sort of gave the impression that his preferred longer term solution might be to establish sort of drinking water stations within each school. So they wouldn't necessarily have to redo all of the infrastructure in the schools, since they don't necessarily know the source of the high levels of the metals, and that these sort of standalone water stations would have their own piping and their own, obviously, new equipment, so that way they could have guaranteed safe water without having to redo all of the infrastructure, just sort of take a guess at what's actually causing the problem. But it'll take at least a couple more months before it's clear sort of on the source of the contamination and what they're going to do about it.
Michigan Radio's Sarah Swick. Thanks, Sarah.
Thank you so much.
Up next, we'll hear what the kids at Dundee High School have to say about this, the first day of school. Stay with us. You're listening to Stateside. I'm Cynthia Canty. It is official. Class is back in session for most students all across Michigan. To usher in this new school year, Stateside's Joey Horan caught up with some students in the village of Dundee on their first day back to school.
Hello, I'm Shane Sterling. I'm from Dundee. We're at Dundee High School. Welcome, everybody. This is actually my senior year, last year, senior season, everybody. I'm looking forward to get my stuff done, enjoy the school year, love the teachers, love the other students, have a great time. Everybody have a blessed year.
I'm Emily, I'm from Dundee High School and I'm a senior.
I'm Hannah, I go to Dundee High School and I'm a senior.
What are you two looking most forward to about senior year?
Getting it over.
Yeah, basically getting it over. Yeah, I'm kind of already prepared for college, started applying and all that.
Same.
Aaron Gesser, I'm from Dundee, Michigan.
What school do you go to?
Riverside Academy. I'm looking forward to meeting new people because my entire life I've gone to Dundee, so this is my first year kind of switching over to schools. And I haven't been doing so good here because I feel like I'm too distracted by all the friends that I've had, but and all that kind of stuff, and I feel like I need to kind of get away from some people and do my own thing so I can get better because I've been slipping, and I'm hoping I can get somewhere in life.
Time to talk sports as we say hello to Michigan radio sports commentator John U. Bacon. And John, let's just get into it and start with Michigan's 24-17 loss to Notre Dame. Were the Irish that good or the Wolverines that bad?
No and no. The Irish were good to very good, but they were not phenomenal. And Michigan, despite the score, despite the feeling of the game, was not at all disastrous. Look at the total yardage. Michigan had 307 yards to Notre Dame's 302. They actually outgained them, not counting the 99-yard kick return, which is, you know, tack that on. So, as a rule, when you win a game, everyone talks about everything you did right. When you lose a game, everyone talks about everything you did wrong, and the margin is not that much. However, it feels, I'm sure, much worse for Michigan fans for the simple reason that they fell behind 14-0, Cindy, in the first 7 minutes. That's 1/8 of a game.
Right out of the game.
And they never seem like they're that determined to come back. So it was, I'm sure, a very hard game for Michigan fans to watch.
So what do you think were Michigan's big mistakes against Notre Dame? And did Coach Harbaugh and his staff do enough to prepare the team for the Irish, in your view?
Well, when you are down 14-0 in the first 7 minutes, you can't argue that they were as prepared as Notre Dame was. And now there's some lucky plays in there, as always, and some flukes and whatnot. And Michigan was very aggressive, which is a good thing. But 14-0 is 14-0. You cannot fall behind like that on the road against a good opponent at night. The home team, by the way, in night games in this series is 8-0. That's not an accident. You and I discussed on this very station last week, Michigan's defense had to give Michigan's offense one quarter to settle in. In other words, 0-0 at the end of the first quarter, Michigan would have been fine. And the exact opposite happened. So that's where the wheels came off.
So how would you grade Shea Patterson with his Michigan debut?
Pretty well, actually. His numbers were good. He was 20 for 30, one interception, no touchdowns. His quarterback rating, for what that's worth, is around 125, which is quite high, actually. Pretty reasonable. And it's his first start for Michigan. And the offensive line did not give him a lot of help. He had very little time back there. He often had to scamper to avoid getting sacked. So I'd give him a solid B+.
So I'm hearing you say things need fixing both in the offense and the defense. So break it down. What did you see that needs to be fixed first in the offense?
Offense, offensive line, which is just what people thought going into the season. The feeling was in the press conferences and amongst the players and whatnot that the O-line would be a whole lot better this year. Didn't look like it on Saturday night. So that's the big thing on offense.
And defense.
Defense. First 7 minutes. After that, look, they
got it together.
Second half, they gave up 3 points. So they gave the offense the entire second half to catch up, and they didn't do it.
It's got to be really a coaching challenge when you suffer a big, when you get your nose bloodied in the very first game of the season. It's got to be understandable that everybody's just feeling down, unhappy. How do you fire them up and go, all right, we've got to look ahead. We've got, you know, we're doing this again next weekend.
Harbaugh's very good at firing guys up, okay. And so is Don Brown, his defensive coach, and others. So I'm confident they'll be ready for Saturday's game. But this is a malaise that goes back a decade now, a little more. In fact, go back to Appalachian State in 07. And there's been a few up years in there, but the 10-year sense of Michigan football is not what it used to be. Has gripped this fan base, and right or wrong, that's what you're dealing with. Now, the fans aren't important for a coach in terms of it's whatever is in your room. Mm-hmm. You know, your players and coaches are all that really matter. So if they're still believing, and I'm sure they are, you're probably going to be okay. But it is no joy in Mudville for this Michigan fan base. And again, it's kind of like being a Red Sox fan in 2000. Mm-hmm. You've not won the World Series since 1918. It's not the current team's fault, but you've been unhappy for 82 years.
Yeah, and you stop and I pulled a few statistics. I see Michigan has 17 straight road losses against ranked teams, and in their last 18 games under Jim Harbaugh, they're 9-9. So, fan base, are the voices of the critics getting louder, and should they get louder?
Well, first of all, you know my caveat on this one. Mm-hmm. Some Michigan fans, not all certainly, but some Michigan fans are not happy unless they're not happy.
Right.
And Saturday night gives them a whole lot of reason to be unhappy. The stat you cite, by the way, that Michigan has lost 17 straight road games against ranked teams, mm-hmm. puts them on a short list with programs like Kansas and Vanderbilt, the worst of their league. Mm-hmm. So that's not exactly a list that Michigan wants to be on. So that's where things are now.
Former Wolverine receiver Braylon Edwards got himself suspended by the Big Ten Network for blowing off steam on Twitter about Michigan's performance, profane, complaining. Words of advice for sports figure before they hop onto Twitter?
Don't. How many lives have been improved by Twitter and how many careers have been crashed? I can't recall too many careers made by Twitter. So, and look, he said later on, the problems with his tweet are several. Look, he's a Michigan, you know, star, obviously, from about 10 years ago or so, 15. He's got the right to vent himself and so on. However, he called out players by name and called them names. That's, no sports journalist does that to college players. They're not paid. They're 20 years old. You got to lay off those guys. Second of all, it's profane. Third problem is he's under contract with the Big Ten Network and doing a very good job, but you signed a contract with stipulations about social media conduct and you violated those rules. So it's not, don't get me started, it's not free speech, people. The government, that's free speech. Your employer, you can't tell your boss to go to hell and expect to work on Monday.
Over to Michigan State, wasn't that season opener against Utah State supposed to be easy breezy, not a white-knuckle ride for Spartan fans?
That is exactly right, but first games are first games. And you saw Penn State barely beat Appalachian State in overtime. Nobody should ever schedule those guys again. Are you listening out there, people? It's twice now. Bo Schembechler always said that you never improve more than you do from your first game to your second game every season. Live ammo is what it feels like, of course, and then you're into the, not to trivialize that, but then you're into the second game. All teams will be substantially better this weekend, so nothing for Michigan State to worry about yet.
Okay, and how did Brian Lewerke do against the Aggies?
His usual solid performance. Yeah. So, hey, the guy tagged him with 38 points. That's not the problem.
So they've got experience. They've got talent. What'd you see as the big blunders?
First game, jitters. Defense looks surprisingly shaky, and that's not a Michigan State hallmark. D'Antonio, the head coach there, Mark D'Antonio, has done traditionally a very good job on defense. Look, they're going to settle down. Spartan fans, rest easy.
And so what are you going to watch for when the Spartans head west to play Arizona State?
A good game. Arizona State's got a new coach in Herm Edwards. They look pretty good in their opener. It's hard to win on the road in college football. So they'll be challenged, but I suspect Michigan State will go back to form and win.
And then circling back to the Wolverines, Western Michigan's coming to the Big House this Saturday.
Don't want to be the Broncos.
They're going to be mad.
Oh, yeah.
Michigan Radio Sports Commentator, John Eubank. And thanks, John.
Thank you.
Time now for local spins as we check out the West Michigan music scene with journalist and music critic John Sinkovich, who's editor and publisher of localspins.com. And John, we're going to start with an artist from Lansing, but she's become such a part of the West Michigan scene. You're laying claim to her?
Yeah, we claim several artists from the Lansing area. This is nothing new, but Jen Siggett is a singer who has been part of the West Michigan music community for a long time, and really anyone who's been involved with the roots music scene in the state in general will recognize and know singer Jen Siggett. She's literally a voice in demand on a lot of different albums and a lot of different projects, including Joshua Davis and others. She plays solo gigs. She does duo shows. She's part of the group Lincoln County Process with Sam Corbin, and she's finally about to release her long-awaited fourth studio album, which is titled appropriately It's About Time, and I think it's been worth the wait. It was produced by Dominic Davis, which many will recognize as Jack White's bassist and also a member of Steppin' In It, and it was recorded at La Luna Recording in Kalamazoo with Ian Gorman, and there's all kinds of guest stars.
Yeah, let's take a listen to a track from this new album. So this is Jen Siggett with Hurricane Rider.
Driving through the hour of a hurricane, threading through a needle in an aeroplane. Trouble ahead, trouble behind, blinded, low and blind. Hurricane rider, hurricane rider. Linger in the levee, but the quay's been breached. Above it, but you're in too deep. Water ahead, dark water behind. Big boat throw out a line. Hurricane rider, hurricane rider.
Playing on this album, who are some of the folks involved in this work? Because it's beautiful.
Yes, she has several national artists on this album, including Luther Dickinson, Colin Linden, and the Mercury Sisters. And then there, of course, are a lot of Michigan favorites and friends, Dominic Davis, Drew Howard, Jeff Ian Lewis, Mike Lynch, Rachel Davis. And the thing I really like about this album is the fact that it's the work of a seasoned writer, a mature songwriter, a lot of soulful and bluesy up-tempo tunes, a tender ballads, and it's someone who's really experienced life, found a way to share that with her listeners.
And she is, I'm getting a sense from your notes here, she's going to be playing all over the place.
Yeah, and officially gets released this album on October 8th. She'll kick off a CD release tour on October 12th at the 10 Pound Fiddle in East Lansing. October 13th at Northfield Mandolins in Marshall. October 14th at Fenville Salt of the Earth. October 18th at Lake Orion's 20 Front Street. October 19th at Detroit's Holding House. And October 20th at Ludington Area Center for the Arts. But before that, she's playing the prestigious Wheatland Music Festival this weekend in Remus.
So she is busy, busy. All right, we're going to take a turn over now to electronic music brought to us by Pink Sky. Before we listen, tell us about this duo.
So it's interesting because I've found that electronic music is taking so many different forms these days and has become so increasingly popular, especially with younger audiences. And this Grand Rapids indie rock, sort of indie electronic duo, it's a married couple of Ryan and Angelica Hay. They do things a little bit differently. Ryan Hay is a musician who used to play in rock and jam bands, wasn't a big fan of using computers for electronic music, but he eventually realized that there's a way to use keyboards and synthesizers and drum machines to achieve that product. So he uses a lot of vintage equipment to create this. Drum machines are programmed by Angelica, and it makes their live show something to really watch. I mean, sometimes I think with the electronic music artist, it's just a guy up front twisting knobs on a computer. These folks really kind of put a performance together because they're using vintage gear.
Let's listen to a track now entitled Breathing. Describe it, it's kind of like everything old is new again, that he's doing things that the early artists who had synthesizers and electronic toys to play with in the studio, how they put it together.
Exactly, but it has a very contemporary feel, and I think anyone who's really sort of attracted to electronic music is really going to get into this album. They are going to be playing on September 22nd at the Pyramid Scheme in Grand Rapids, and for those attending Art Prize in late September, they're also part of the two-day Blue Bridge Music Festival, which is going to take place on a pedestrian bridge over the Grand River in downtown Grand Rapids.
Fun, fun. Now we turn to a band from Grand Rapids that you think this band's really one of the up-and-coming stars of the indie rock scene?
Yeah, and it's interesting because they haven't put out a whole lot of material, but I think the stuff that they've released thus far is really impressive. Guitarist and singer David Stout actually started this band called Tiger and Frame under the moniker David Stout. They released an EP in early 2017 that was featured on the iTunes Alternative Hot EPs and singles page. They started touring the Midwest, and they recently released this single titled Mechanic.
I'm
And now with this single, it's the building block. You say there's an EP in the works?
Yes, they're working on a new EP, and they plan to book a headlining show in Grand Rapids when that's completed. They also have plans for a big national tour in 2019, for which they haven't yet announced details. I think they consider their music authentic and relatable, and I think that's part of it, but I also think it's very catchy.
So Tiger in Frame, I can tell this band is under the heading of Keep Your Eye on These Guys.
Absolutely.
John Sinkovich is the editor and publisher of LocalSpins.com, where you can find lots more about these artists and other great West Michigan artists. John, thanks so much.
Thank you very much. Much appreciated.
Support for arts and culture coverage comes in part from the Michigan Council for Arts and Cultural Affairs. Coming up, we find out just how climate change could affect Michigan's coastline and sand dunes. That's in about 10 minutes. Stay with us. You're listening to Stateside. I'm Cynthia Canty. It was the deadliest battle and the biggest U.S. defeat in the entire War of 1812, and it all happened in Monroe. The Battle of the River Raisin helped form the policy leading to the forced removal of Michigan's native tribes, pushing them west. It led to the battle cry, "Remember the River Raisin." Well, now there are big plans to get Americans to do exactly that. A $100 million redevelopment of the River Raisin National Battlefield is underway. And Tony Cooper's executive director for the River Raisin National Battlefield Park Foundation. Tony, the War of 1812 saw British and Canadian soldiers with their native allies fighting against the U.S. troops. Briefly, tell us what happened during this battle in January 1813.
The battle was an interesting battle because it was between U.S. and British soldiers, but it also included the Native Americans and the French. And of the Native American, we can trace 20 Native nations back to this battle. And it was essentially a battle of land. So the British wanted the land for themselves, the Americans wanted the land for themselves, and the Native Americans and French just wanted to protect the land that they were already living on. So what happened with the battle is the British and the Americans basically made the Native nations take sides. And it became one of the deadliest battles in American history. It also is the site where more POWs were removed from American soil than ever in history. And so what ended up happening there is the British won. The Battle of the River Raisin, they had it, and essentially the Americans came back. And eventually they defeated the British after lots of deaths, after lots of POWs removed. What ended up happening, though, is Chief Tecumseh from the Native Nations rallied the Native Nations to come back and fight for their land, take back their land that was theirs, and that's what helped the British defeat the United States. When the whole thing was done and the United States came back, it ended up happening because policies were made. So the United States started saying, they killed us, these savages, they need to be defeated. And in order to do that, they said, remember the raisin was the rally cry that they said in order to say, hey, we need to come back. We need to rally against these individuals. We need to rally against these savages. It was horrible. It was a deadly battle. Lots of people were killed in this battle. And it ended up leading to Native American policy, Indian removal. You know, a lot of people think Indian removal happened where the St. Louis Arches are, but the Indian Removal Act was actually signed right here in Michigan, in southeast Michigan, which started forcing the Native nations to move out west.
It's amazing since that so much history happened at this site, at the River Raisin National Battlefield, yet somehow the War of 1812 just doesn't get the attention that the Revolutionary War gets, certainly that the Civil War gets, when I'm thinking of, you know, visits I've made to Gettysburg and Appomattox and New Market and many other battle sites. And I know that this redevelopment, you're hoping to really shine this attention back onto the War of 1812. Tell us about these redevelopment plans.
What we're trying to do is tell the untold story of the War of 1812 from an educational perspective, but also from an immersion perspective. So there'll be a few pieces to it. The huge development is a 20-year corridor plan that includes economic development, an amphitheater, and more. But right now, what we're focusing on is recreating the frontier life. So equivalent to what, like, most people in Michigan would understand Greenfield Village. So if you think of the Greenfield Village of the War of 1812, so they'll get immersed into frontier life. They'll learn about how they lived here before the war occurred. They'll learn about fur trading, rope making, blacksmith, and we're going to rebuild all these houses. So through a grant, a DNR grant, that we have been able to purchase houses, and through another grant, tear these houses down. And what's going to happen is that whole development's going to occur within the next few years, where you're going to start seeing frontier life recreated.
Tony, when is the earliest visitors will start to see these new improvements?
The houses have been purchased from willing sellers, and those will start being torn down this month. I don't have an exact date, but it will be this month. And then the development will occur. The first building will be built within the next 12 months. So you can say that by spring of 2019, you'll see the first building going up.
And ultimately, how far out will it take to really transform the battlefield? How many years?
I would say within the next 5 years, you're going to start seeing a big transformation. And then the complete project is supposed to be done within 20 years.
I guess your hope would be, when you think of the visitors coming to Gettysburg and so many of the other Civil War sites, to be able to draw as many visitors to the Monroe area.
Yeah, we want to be one of the top tourist destinations in the area. Michigan State University did a study that once this is all completed, we should expect 1 million visitors in southeast Michigan.
So, Tony, what's happening September 15th?
We have Rally on the River Raisin. It's a free event where visitors from anywhere can come and see what frontier life was like. And they can do rope making, candle making, fur trading, and all the aspects of frontier life, getting a preview of what's to come here at the battlefield.
Tony Cooper is the executive director for the River Raisin National Battlefield Park Foundation. Tony, thanks so much for being with us on Stateside.
Thank you, Cynthia.
The long Labor Day weekend marked the unofficial end of summer. The beach towels have been packed away and the boats may have been docked for the season. But before we say a very final goodbye to our weekends at Michigan's beaches, we have one more listener question about the Great Lakes. Let's take a listen.
My name is Jennifer LaRoji, and I'm from New Hudson, Michigan. My question is climate change affecting the sand dunes in up north Michigan, and is it affecting the coastal landscape?
For the answer, we turn to Alan Arbogast. He's professor and chair of the Department of Geography at Michigan State University. Alan, it's great to have you with us.
Pleasure to be here.
So before we talk climate change, let's do dunes 101, if you will. You say Michigan's coastal dunes are global in their grandeur. How exactly did the dunes form?
Yeah, it's really pretty simple, quite frankly. The raw material is sand, as everyone knows. That sand originated from the Canadian Shield in Canada, and it was brought south during the ice ages by glaciers. In turn, it was deposited on the Michigan landscape, you know, in that earlier period of time. The sand is then reworked. It's eroded from bluffs as the Great Lakes have risen and fallen through time. Since the ice ages, the sand goes into the lake, it moves along the lake shore, deposited in beaches, and then it blows up to form dunes.
Okay, and yet there are misconceptions about how dunes are formed. What are some of the misconceptions you hear from people?
Well, commonly that with respect to their age, that's kind of the big one. I've been working on this landscape since the late 90s, and the assumption at that time was that the dunes had formed largely during one event that occurred about 5,000 years ago after a high lake stage. And that lake was about 15 feet higher than it is now. When the lake fell from that stage, there was a lot of available sand, and that sand blew up to form the dunes. And that was sort of the prevailing paradigm at that time. Actually, in some of the environmental literature of that era, there was another view that the conditions that had produced them were over 10,000 years old, and that they were directly formed in some way, shape, or form because of the ice ages. And neither one of those paradigms was true. We started dating them with radiocarbon dating and another method that's called optical stimulated luminescence dating. And we discovered that indeed they began to form about 5,000 years ago, but that they've evolved in a very complex way since that period of time, with distinct periods of growth and then distinct periods of time when the dunes weren't growing much or any at all. Those variations are related to fluctuations in the lake, maybe more or less storminess during those periods of time, but that the history is actually quite complex.
And how do the misconceptions impact the way that we think about preserving coastal dunes?
I guess the question is, what does preserving mean? And there's a lot of talk about that, and I've been involved in some of those discussions. One obvious way that dunes can be impacted that has been high in the public consciousness has been through sand mining. Dunes have been, quote-unquote, destroyed because of sand mining in over time. No question about that. And people feel strongly about that dune landscape and have reactions to that. Another way of impacting dunes that people have is by stabilizing them. Our coastal dunes are meant to move. They're highly mobile at times. And if vegetation or homes and parking lots and driveways and things like that expand over the dunes, then they will become stable. And so they won't move anymore. And one could say, well, that would be a way of impacting the dunes. So when you say preserving them, the question that I always ask in return is, well, what do you want to preserve? If you want to preserve their mobility and their natural function, that's one thing. If you're wanting to make sure that they aren't being destroyed by sand mining in certain isolated spots, that's something else.
And I'm hearing you say human development and vegetation locks the dunes in place, in a sense, preventing them from this ever-changing natural process that has been part of what they are for eons.
Yeah, I mean, that is true. We're working on a study right now, a group of us, where we're looking at air photos from the early 30s or late 30s when they were originally taken to the present time to look at the expansion of vegetation across dune landscapes and parks up and down the lakeshore, because we're using the parks as the natural zones, and in virtually all of them, the expansion of vegetation, even in the parks, has been extensive and rapid in some cases, and that's with people walking on them. So if you build on them and lock them in place, it's going to have the same effect. Now, the question is, what do people want? I'm asking that rhetorically.
Mm-hmm.
If that's what they want, that's fine. But, you know, that does have an impact, no doubt about it.
And now to Jennifer's question about climate change. First of all, can you break down the difference for us between coastal erosion and changes to dunes?
Oh, sure. I started studying sand dunes in Kansas when I was doing my PhD work, and there's lots of sand dunes in the Great Plains. Half of Nebraska is covered by sand dunes. And what makes a sand dune is the fact that it's sand that was deposited by the wind. So we're lucky here in Michigan is there's so much sand along the beaches that the wind, prevailing winds from the west, can blow the sand and create dunes. Those dunes are going to erode and move and bury things and uncover things all on their own, okay, whether the lake is going up or whether the lake is going down. Coastal erosion per se is more of a kind of a wave process where when the lake comes up and strong waves hit the shoreline, then you're going to have more coastal erosion. Now, some of that erosion might be where dunes happen to be, but much of the worst erosion that's going on the coast is where there are no dunes at all.
So what threat, then, Alan, does climate change pose first to Michigan's coastline?
Well, that's uncertain, which is not always a good answer, I know, but it's true. The models suggest that in the coming decades, we're going to see generally more precipitation that is released into the lakes and the lakes go up. If it's warmer in the wintertime, you might have less ice cover, which means there's more evaporation. So what impact that has on the lakes is uncertain. But in all probability, the lakes might go up some, okay? Now, they've fluctuated a lot historically and in the prehistoric. We know that. That work's been well documented. The lakes have gone up. The lakes have gone down quite a lot. Okay. The impact of climate change and more precipitation gradually on lake level, and erosion is really hard to judge. I think it's more of a, if the lake goes up, there are certain areas of the coastline that are going to be flooded where people happen to live or have businesses and whatnot in towns and marinas and things like that. And I think that would be probably the bigger concern. Shoreline erosion has been going on forever in Lake Michigan. So it's really hard to judge. It would be wrong of me to try to say that there's any one answer.
And is the same answer apply to the question, what threat does climate change pose to our sand dunes? Would you basically...
Yeah, it does. It's uncertain. If we are indeed receiving more precipitation, that would have a tendency to further allow vegetation to expand across the dunes. We know that happened in the past, and it could very well happen in the future. We're seeing it in the state parks now. And so with more plant cover, that means there's less sand that's bare, which means that there's less sand blowing around.
What do you feel are the most important things that we in Michigan can and should do to protect Michigan's dunes and coastal landscape?
Okay, so I'm gonna turn that question on its head for you.
Sure.
What does it mean to you to protect the coastal dunes?
I think people would say to know that the dunes are there for future generations to be able to experience and enjoy.
Okay, by that, does the question imply that the dunes are there to enjoy with extensive patches of bare sand that is moving around and doing the dune thing?
Yeah.
See what I'm saying?
Yeah. It's very slippery.
it is kind of a slippery slope. And one could argue that by allowing them to lock in place, that they are going to be preserved as sand dunes. Now, they're going to be sort of fossilized dunes and that they're not going to be active, and that's going to have impact on species, you know, plovers and pitcher's thistle and well-known plant and animal species like that, but they're not going to be active, which for a lot of people would be a good thing. The Europeans, interestingly, have gone for the past 20 years in kind of an opposite direction, where they're doing things to try to ensure that dunes remain active. The last time that the state revisited the Sand Dune Protection Management Act, which was originally passed in 76, they looked at it again, I think it was in 2012, and they included some language to preserve the dynamic nature of coastal sand dunes in Michigan. Well, what does that mean? And how does that conflict with what people naturally desire, which is to live in stable places that aren't moving under their feet? You know what I mean?
Alan, what kind of forecasting are you able to do based on your historical research of Michigan's coastal dunes? What do you think the outlook is, say, for the next 100 years?
Wow, that's a great question. I think the people in the state of Michigan have a choice to make about what they want for the Michigan sand dunes. If present degree of development continues for the next 100 years, my hypothesis would be that the dunes would be increasingly stabilized, and with fewer and fewer patches of bare sand, that the ecosystem would become fragmented, and there would be extensive reaches along the shoreline where, you know, it's locked in place and that's the way it's going to stay, and there'll be some more isolated places where it remains dynamic. But I think that's the big choice that folks in Michigan have about what they want that dune landscape to look like in 100 years. I think that's if you want to call it a threat, using that term cautiously, you know, sand mining itself, those places tend to be isolated, while maybe unsightly locally and causing some problems locally. I think the biggest overall threat, and again, I use that term cautiously, is that it's going to become a fossilized landscape in the next 100 years.
There are so many facets I think the general public would not understand, and you've shown us there's no cut and dried answer, and that's for sure. Alan Arbogast, professor and chair of the Department of Geography at Michigan State University. Alan, thank you so much for sharing your work with us.
You bet. It's always fun to talk about Michigan sand dunes.
And before we go, we want to welcome new listeners. Today is the first day stateside, along with all of Michigan Radio's programming, can be heard in Port Huron. Blue Water Region listeners hear us on 91.3 FM WSRX. So welcome. I'm Cynthia Canty. Thank you so much for listening.